From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. On today's program, the White House orders up fresh policy options on Syria as the peace talks in Geneva stall. The high-stakes battle over union membership at a Volkswagen plant in Tennessee.
I'm optimistic or hopeful that the UAW will be successful in their vote, but I think it'll be close.
The German retiree who was revealed last year to have a hoard of 1,400 priceless artworks, now we know he had a second stash. I'll get the details from FSN's Sandra Gutman. And President Obama in California shining a light on the state's drought.
We got a tenth of an inch last night. The question is, how long does that plant going to live with no rain for another week or two?
That's ahead on FSN Reports after our summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Hume. Two people are confirmed dead and more than 100,000 Indonesians have been evacuated from their homes. It follows a powerful volcanic eruption on the Indonesian island of Java. Seven airports have been forced to close, stranding thousands of passengers. For FSN, Arthur Stevens reports from Melbourne.
The alert status for Mount Kelud, considered one of the most dangerous volcanoes on the densely populated island of Java, was raised late on Thursday, just hours before it began erupting. TV images showed ash and rocks raining down on nearby villages. International airports in the Javanese cities of Surabaya, Yogyakarta and Solo were closed temporarily. Around 200,000 people from 36 villages in a 10-kilometre area around Kelud in eastern Java have been told to evacuate. I'm Arthur Stevens, Melbourne.
Italian Prime Minister Enrico Letta has announced his resignation, with Florence Mayor Matteo Renzi poised to take over the job. It would make him Italy's youngest Prime Minister. Letta received a vote of no confidence, with his party calling for a new administration. He had only been in post for 10 months after forming a coalition government with the centre-right. From FSN's Brussels Bureau, Jack Parrock reports.
Enrico Letta has resigned as the Prime Minister of Italy after his own party called for him to step down. Relations between Mr. Letta and the leader of his Democratic Party, Matteo Renzi, have been publicly fraught. Mr. Renzi has been increasingly critical of economic policies and lack of administrative reforms. Unemployment in Italy has been at its highest level for 40 years, and the economy has shrunk by 9% over the last 7 years. Matteo Renzi is now expected to take over as head of government, making him the third successive prime minister to not be directly elected by the Italian people. Jack Parrock, Brussels.
CNN host Piers Morgan, also a former editor of UK tabloid The Daily Mirror, has been questioned by police over alleged phone hacking. From FSN's London Bureau, Ollie Barrett has more.
Piers Morgan has confirmed he was interviewed by police over phone hacking in December of last year. He was questioned by Scotland Yard as part of an investigation into alleged hacking at Mirror Group newspapers. The 48-year-old was not arrested. Piers Morgan edited the Daily Mirror between 1995 and 2004 before being sacked over fake photographs the newspaper published, said to be of British soldiers abusing an Iraqi. The phone hacking scandal has led to a series of criminal proceedings and caused media tycoon Rupert Murdoch to close his News of the World newspaper in 2011. Ollie Barrett, London.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. France has announced it is to send an additional 400 troops to the Central African Republic in a bid to help put an end to the violence. This brings the total number of temporary deployments to 2,000, with French soldiers working alongside 5,500 African Union peacekeepers. France is calling on other countries to show their support in ending what the UN is describing as possible ethnic cleansing. Christian militias involved in the attacks say they are taking revenge for killings by Muslims carried out last year. United Nations humanitarian chief Valerie Amos has told the UN Security Council it is failing the people of Syria. Amos told the council it was unacceptable that humanitarian laws were still being flagrantly violated. Syrian Deputy Foreign Minister Faisal Mekdad has responded, saying the Syrian government is doing its best to improve humanitarian aid access. Well, Nick Harper reports from FSN's New York Bureau.
The Under-Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, Valerie Amos, said that despite the Security Council unanimously calling for action 4 months ago to help civilians in Syria, the conflict had in fact intensified. She warned that international humanitarian laws continue to be consistently and flagrantly violated. She said all members of the 15-man council must use their influence to persuade the parties in Syria to enable ceasefires and allow regular humanitarian access. 1,400 civilians have been evacuated from Homs, but the UN estimates another 250,000 people remain in besieged areas. Meanwhile, UN brokered peace talks between the Syrian government and opposition continue in Syria, but show no signs of progress. Nick Harper, New York.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Hume reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports.
The friends of Syria, the United States, Russia, these countries can play a very positive role. We hope that they will do that because Syrians have suffered so much, too much.
Luay Safi of the Syrian National Council, the country's main opposition group, pleading with the international community to step in and save the peace talks underway in Geneva that today appeared badly stalled. In Beijing, Secretary of State John Kerry said he's been asked by President Obama to prepare more policy options for the United States in Syria. He spoke as optimism evaporated about the chances for a successful outcome of the Geneva talks. There, it was reported that the Syrian government refused even to look at a 24-point plan proposed by the opposition. UN mediator Lakhdar Brahimi blamed the government for the talks' failure to progress. The opposition accused the Russians of reneging on promises to pressure the government of President Bashar al-Assad. From Washington, FSN's Alice Alstein reports.
Trilateral talks between the U.S., Russia, and the United Nations deteriorated further on Friday, as Russia's foreign minister accused the United States of using the peace talks to push for regime change in Syria. Speaking in Moscow, he took issue with the United States' repeated assertion that the future of Syria should not include President Bashar al-Assad. Luay Safi of the Syria National Council responded by accusing the Russian government of undermining the process.
Russia has decided now to defend the line of the regime. That is to say, they don't want to start to talk about the peace, political process, and just want to discuss issues separately.
White House spokesperson Jay Carney also fired back Friday afternoon, saying the Syrian government has not lived up to its international obligations.
The main problem is the regime's unwillingness so far to engage constructively on the implementation of the Geneva communique. The opposition, by contrast, has shown a seriousness of purpose. They continue to outline their vision for the future of Syria, and we commend them for that.
Even as the U.S. State Department and United Nations express frustration with the stalled process in Geneva and escalating violence in Syria and call for new options to be explored, Carney told reporters it's important not to give up on the diplomatic process.
We are far from achieving the goal we envision here, but we have to keep at it. There is no other way to resolve this ongoing crisis that doesn't involve the two sides sitting across from each other at a table.
This week, the UN Security Council received a briefing on the situation in Syria, where 15 aid workers have been killed since October, despite negotiated ceasefires aimed at getting supplies to blockaded civilians. But the Council has not yet reached an agreement on a resolution. Australia, Jordan, and Luxembourg proposed one draft this week, calling for punitive measures for individuals and entities that obstruct humanitarian aid delivery into fighting zones. But Russia dismissed that text as a non-starter and proposed its own late Wednesday, which has no enforcement language. Security Council diplomats say they hope the two versions can be reconciled. Meanwhile, aid workers and international observers on the ground have their own criticisms about the peace process. Noah Gottschalk with Oxfam International says several important topics are not being addressed.
This conflict is being fueled by weapons coming from outside the country. And that's why it's essential that all sides of the conflict and all parties stop sending weapons and ammunition into this crisis, because it's only making the conflict worse and increasing the harm that's being done to Syrian civilians. Recent reports that the United States has resumed arming the opposition is really alarming. And, of course, Russia and others continue to supply weapons to the government, and that's also a problem. All that arming should stop. The arming of the parties to the conflict threatens the already fragile negotiations and the fragile political process.
Gottschalk says enforceable measures to end or at least reduce this trafficking of weapons must be part of whatever agreement comes out. He also criticized the negotiators for excluding women's organizations, civil society groups, and independent Syrian activists who traveled to Switzerland for the talks but were left standing outside with no meaningful way to participate. As the violence continued Friday with reports of a deadly car bomb outside a mosque in the southern city of Yehuda, Secretary of State John Kerry said at a press conference in Beijing that Syria is the planet's greatest humanitarian crisis today, and said President Obama has asked him and his whole team to evaluate all options going forward. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Now to Tennessee, where workers at Volkswagen's plant in Chattanooga are deciding on whether to join the United Auto Workers Union. The ongoing vote, due to conclude on Friday night, has turned into a high-stakes contest between unions and outside conservative groups that have been funding efforts to secure a no vote. On Thursday, Senator Bob Corker, a long-term foe of the UAW, stepped into the fray. He said that he's been assured by Volkswagen that if the workforce rejects the move to unionize, the plant will be rewarded by being given a new product to build. A successful effort to unionize in a southern right-to-work state would be seen as a major victory for organized labor. FSN's Malcolm Brown spoke to Art Wheaton, who follows the auto industry at Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations.
I expect it to be a very close vote. I think from Wednesday through Friday, as they collect the votes for the UAW, I think it's fairly close. I'm optimistic or hopeful that the UAW will be successful in their vote, and that would allow them to have a works council at Volkswagen. But I think it'll be close. I think there's been a lot of pressure from both sides, or actually three different sides, from the government, from anti-union entities, and from the UAW or the workers. So it's not a quiet voting place.
Yeah, you mentioned that outside pressure. Obviously, you've got business lobby groups and conservatives piling in. You've got unions too. What are the stakes involved for all the parties?
Well, the biggest thing for Volkswagen and their Volkswagen workers, the biggest thing is the U.S. labor law does not allow Volkswagen to have a works council in the United States without having a union to represent the workers. So Volkswagen has about 60 different manufacturing plants around the world, and the Chattanooga plant is the only one that doesn't have a union and the only one that is not participating in the works councils. So for Volkswagen and their workers, the biggest thing at stake for them is the opportunity to have a voice or a say in who gets to build the next great Volkswagen SUV. Would it be the Chattanooga folks, or would it be Mexico or someplace else? And without having a union, they don't even get a chance to cast a vote.
If the workers of VW were to vote to join the UAW, what implications would that have across the South, do you think, in the auto sector?
This would be the first foreign nameplate to get a union in the right-to-work South. So that's the big implications. If they can get Volkswagen to have a union, then that will put more pressure on BMW and Mercedes to allow a neutral or a non-negative union campaign in their plants.
Now, some of the outside money that's coming into this decision, trying to influence it, particularly on the business side, is saying that that would in fact be essentially a business and jobs killer, that it would undercut some of the South's advantage at the moment. What's your response to that?
It's exactly the same rhetoric you will hear in the entire U.S. about raising the minimum wage, that raising the minimum wage is a job killer. It's what people tend to say. That doesn't make it a fact. So I don't think it would be a job killer. I think it actually would enhance the workplace for Volkswagen. They see that as their competitive advantage. That's how Volkswagen says our way to go is to have a union, and I don't see it as a big deterrent.
And what about the stakes for the UAW and unions in general? Union membership has declined over the years. Do they see this as their way, a model to come back?
I think so. I think they see it as a way of maintaining relevance, that Bob King, the UAW International president, has basically said, if we don't organize some of these plants in the South, then we will not be relevant and may not be around in the future. The last foreign nameplate for the UAW to organize was Volkswagen. Volkswagen had a unionized plant in Pennsylvania from 1978 to 1987, and it closed down for lack of sales and couldn't justify the business model. So they've had a UAW plant before, but they haven't been able to organize any of the other trans plants since the 1970s.
Now, you look specifically at the auto sector, but what's your sense of how this is being regarded across the U.S. economy more generally? Presumably employers and unions elsewhere in non-auto related industries are following this.
Absolutely. It's a pretty big deal because it's, in general, it's the trend towards going to more states becoming right-to-work states. And one of the principal reasons they become a right-to-work state, which happened in Michigan, which was happening in Indiana, it's happened in other states, is to try to avoid unions or to weaken unions. So if the unions were able to have an organized workplace in a right-to-work state, especially in the tough international auto industry, that would be a sign that, hey, maybe unions are still, you know, powerful or relevant or have a stake in the U.S. workplace.
Art Wheaton of Cornell's School of Industrial and Labour Relations. Now to Germany and the curious case of Cornelius Gurlitt. If the name rings a bell, he's the 81-year-old German recluse whose home in Munich was discovered to contain a priceless collection of 1,400 artworks, many of which may have been looted by the Nazis during World War II. Well, today it was reported that Mr. Gurlitt had a second stash of art in a second home in the Austrian city of Salzburg. Joining me from FSN's Europe desk in Brussels is our bureau chief there, Sandra Gartman. And Sandra, how was this second hoard found and what does it contain?
Well, this second hoard is much smaller than the first. The first hoard that was discovered in Munich, Germany, contained works of around 1,400 pieces. This is much smaller. It's about 60. But the most interesting aspect of this new discovery is the fact that it's believed to contain bigger or more well-known works of art, French Impressionist artists. There could be Renoirs or Monets and even Picassos among them. So this is another treasure trove of works of art that were believed to have been lost forever during World War II. And it has many members of the art world excited, but there's many questions that remain. Members of Jewish communities are saying that there's questions that must be answered as to how these works were obtained, and they feel that there needs to be more solid investigations as to Mr. Cornelius Gurlitt's inheritance.
And what do we know about the provenance of these artworks? I know his attorney is denying that any of them was expropriated during the Second World War, but how did he get his hands on them? Do we know?
Well, what we do know is that Mr. Gurlitt and his father were prominent art dealers. And according to the Claims Conference, which is a Holocaust restitution organization, Cornelius's father, Mr. Hildebrandt Gurlitt, was one of four art dealers commissioned by Hitler himself to handle stolen art. That is a claim that they've made. And of course, Mr. Gurlitt denies this. And he also denies that his father was involved in backroom deals. He said that all the works that he acquired were bought legally from museums and other dealers rather than through deals with private individuals. And now his spokesman also says that an initial assessment of the works of art that were found in his possession weren't stolen. And of course, this is a claim that they've made, and there are ongoing further assessments as to whether that statement is entirely correct.
And at what point did investigators become aware that this second hoard existed? And is there any reason to believe that there might be more art out there in other apartments elsewhere?
Well, that is a very interesting question. But at the moment, authorities both in Germany and in Austria are keeping very tight-lipped about it. The prime example of how secret this whole discovery of stolen artworks has been was that back in 2012, when this discovery was made by German authorities, who at the time were in fact initiating a tax probe into Mr. Gurlitt's possessions. They hadn't told anyone about this, and it wasn't until a year later that a German magazine published this discovery that people found out about it.
FSN's Sandra Gutman on the line from our Europe desk in Brussels. President Obama traveled to California today, escaping the snow that has engulfed Washington and heading to Rancho Mirage for a summit meeting with Jordan's King Abdullah. He's also using his trip to California in a bid to bring national attention to the state's ongoing drought. The president has been discussing what federal measures can be taken to help deal with the water shortages that are threatening economic pain for the country's agricultural powerhouse. FSN's San Francisco Cisco correspondent Rebecca Bowring has been to meet a farmer who says he's never seen conditions this bad.
In Sonol in Alameda County, southeast of San Francisco, the sky is almost cloudless. A winter sun beats down on the home of Frank Imhoff, farmer and cattle rancher. There are green leaves on the trees, but the earth is bone dry. Imhoff has been working in agriculture all his adult life.
It's the driest it's been. It's probably worse than 76.
Imhoff has a herd of about 200 cows. He feeds them hay bales from the back of his trailer. He's been buying in the hay from 900 miles away because without any rain, the grass has barely grown. Digging for seedlings, he finds blades with long, straggly roots trying to chase moisture.
We got a tenth of an inch last night, which ain't much. The question is, how long does that plant gonna live with no rain for another week or two?
Imhoff's just had an emergency powwow with his children, away at university, to discuss their strategy. The family decided they'd have to sell 30 to 40 cows. Cattle prices are high at the moment, but there's a trade-off.
We took some calves to sale last week and we did good on them. But if you're making the money out of this hand, you're just handing over on this hand, buying hay.
California's in the grip of a drought, being called the driest period in the state's recorded history. It's been going on for 6 years. Some scientists who study the West Coast's long-term climate patterns through tree rings and sediment worry this could be another mega drought, common in California's early history. Lynn Ingram is a paleoclimatologist at the University of California at Berkeley and author of The West Without Water.
Every roughly 50 to 90 years, we've had a drought that's lasted at least a decade, maybe a little longer, and so we're in a drier cycle. But we also see evidence for trends that suggest that warming is already impacting us here in the West.
The San Francisco Public Utilities Commission serves 2.6 million households and businesses in the Bay Area with water. While storage levels are currently normal, reservoirs aren't filling up this year with snowmelt from the Sierra Nevada mountains. Steve Ritchie is Assistant General Manager for Water.
We have already asked our customers to voluntarily reduce their use by 10%, which is a significant amount of water because they already are very efficient at using water. We are actively working on a project to build a pipeline to one of our reservoirs that is in a secondary water supply. So we're starting work on that project right now.
The commission doesn't rely on state or federal funds. Ritchie says they'd certainly be interested if any were released. But the priority lies now in helping California's worst drought-hit regions like the Central Valley. Cold comfort for Frank Imhoff on his parched farm in Sanol as he wonders how many more of his cows he may have to part with. Rebecca Bowring, San Francisco.
And now we journey from the Californian drought to the Indonesian volcano. Volcanic ash from a major eruption closed several international airports and sent thousands of people fleeing from the country's most densely populated island. Mount Kelud exploded overnight, showering rocks and hot lava onto surrounding towns in an eruption that was heard over 100 miles away. FSN's Rebecca Foster spoke to Dr. Anya Schmidt of the University of Leeds in Britain. She's monitoring the volcano's activity.
So basically, it's not an unusual event because in Indonesia, we have more than 100 active volcanoes. So what you see is really not unusual. The last eruption of this volcano of the same magnitude happened in 1990. And basically now, magma, this is molten rock that sits in the crust of our Earth, built up and the pressure built up, and then now we have a new eruption from this volcano.
So we know that at least two people actually died after the weight of ash caused their house to collapse. So it kind of seems like the ash itself is one of the greatest dangers in this sort of situation. Is that true?
So basically at the moment, volcanic ash is really the greatest danger or hazard. So we have heavy ash fall at the moment in an area of several hundreds of kilometers around the volcano. And it's a bit hard to tell from a distance, but there are reports that about 8 inches of ash fell. So if you have ash fall that's that heavy, then the roofs from houses will collapse. If you inhale volcanic ash, this can have negative effects on your health. So I heard reports about 3 people that died, 2 from roof collapses, and apparently 1 due to inhalation of volcanic ash.
So how rare is this sort of volcanic event? I know you said the last one was in 1990, and are we looking at any chance of further eruptions?
So as such, the event is not rare. So we classify volcanic eruptions by the magnitude of eruption, and this is what we call a magnitude 4 eruption. And on average, there's 1 eruption per year of such a magnitude. And in 1990, the eruption had the same or a similar magnitude than the one we saw yesterday. There could be more eruptions from this volcano in the next couple of days, but it's really difficult to tell.
And finally, Dr. Schmidt, can you comment on what sort of rebuilding process this community is facing and what kinds of long-term environmental impacts might this eruption have on this community?
So first of all, the community, they obviously have they have to clean up the volcanic ash that fell on their houses. In terms of long-term environmental effects, as such, volcanic ash acts as a fertilizer for soils, so it's good for soils. However, if there's heavy ash fall, then it might well be that the soil becomes wasteland, so they cannot farm on the soil anymore. But if there's only minor ash fall, then it's actually a good thing for the soil.
Dr. Anya Schmidt of the University of Leeds. And that's Friday's edition of FSN Reports. Let us know what you think of the programme. You can email us at reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. Coming up on Monday, an extended interview with Nick Turse, author of a new book, Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam.
He heard his lieutenant on the radio ask what should be done with 19 civilians that they had rounded up. And the captain, a West Point train captain, said, "You know the orders that came down from higher headquarters this morning. Kill anything that moves."
That's Nick Turse in a special edition of FSN Reports on Monday. But for now, I'm Simon Marks in Washington, alongside producer Kevin McAleese and Rebecca Hume on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.